The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Leroy Logan. Leroy is a former superintendent in the Metropolitan Police and a former chair of the Black Police Association. His new book, Closing Ranks, My Life as a Cop, is available now. And this December, his story is the focus of an episode of Steve McQueen's Small Axe six-part BBC series. Leroy, welcome to Table Talk.
Thank you very much for that intro, and it's really good to be here.
It's lovely to have you. We're going to start where we always do, at the beginning. Could you tell us about your first memories of food?
My first memory of food? Wow. My first memory of food, actually, was when I was a youngster in Jamaica. I was born in London, but during primary school, my mother took my sister and myself back to Jamaica because she came over in the Windrush generation and she got a bit homesick, so she went back with us. So I just loved the mangoes and the fruits, the pineapple and the papaya and everything. And that is my most vivid memory of food. It was just the fruits and the interesting different food that I had from London, which I'd left. I wasn't great on school dinners, so I really enjoyed the change in diet when I went to Jamaica. So that's my earliest memories.
And you must have been just old enough to be able to recognise the difference between what you'd had before. Was there anything you missed?
Apple crumble.
A good choice.
Oh, that is the only thing I missed was apple crumble. And custard, of course.
Of course. And what were meal times like in Jamaica?
Meal times? Oh, it was very early. I mean, we used to get up at the crack of dawn, because classes started at 8 a.m. So you had this inspection at about 7:30, and they played the national anthem, the British national anthem, because even though we'd recently got independence in 1962, but they still played the national anthem at schools. And so to attend to the national anthem, and then you were in class from 8 a.m. to about 2 in the afternoon, and there was no nonsense about talking in class. Very, very strict, because I left London where you could talk in class and, you know, get away with some of that. No. So I had to find out the hard way. You did not talk in class.
And after school, when you were at home, what sorts of dishes did your mum cook for you?
The national dish is ackee and saltfish. So there's this fruit, it's like a yellow fleshy type of vegetable, and they mix it with saltfish. And so I used to love that. And I used to love plantains, boiled plantain, fried plantain. And I used to love the curry goat and rice. Yeah, I love the fish. They used to season it in such a, well, just the smell alone was enough. So it was a lot of fresh fruit and vegetables, sweet potatoes. It was so different from pie and chips and fish and chips and chips and chips.
And how important was eating together to Jamaican culture, or to your family particularly?
Critical. It was very important because we lived in a sort of like a compound, so all the houses were joined up in like a square type, and you had the central yard and people would be out their verandas and talking to each other, and we exchanged dishes. My mother was a great cook, so she would always be exchanging meals with other people. And in fact, I used to take advantage of my London accent. So the children used to pay me money to speak with my best London accent. And I'd have them like in a classroom situation, and I'd be preaching to them. So my nickname was called Deacon, because they thought I'd be some sort of pastor or something, you know, because I'd talk like I was in, in a church, and these were my flock. But yeah, it was like a village type set up. So, and they always say, you know, it's not a person that grows a child, it's the village. And it's, they really played it out in Jamaica, very much so. And that sort of openness. And everyone looked like me, you know, that was a great thing. Quite a contrast to London, which I'd left. So I saw black teachers, doctors, people in authority like police, and it didn't. And that's why I could relate to, well, actually, if they can do it, I can do it. If I can see it, then it's possible.
You then came back to the UK after school to go to university. What was it like returning and sort of what was the food like when you arrived back in London?
Well, I came back in time for England to win the World Cup in 1966, and that was great. So there was that real nostalgia, and but I returned to Apple Crumble, so I was pleased with that. And I must admit, I did miss the fish and chips. But my mother always used to cook sort of Caribbean food anyway. So I got that continuity, but I still love going to the Wimpy. I don't know if they're still around, actually. So the Wimpy was my port of call. I like going to the pie and mash shop, even though I wasn't great on that liquor stuff. But the pie and the mash and sometimes the peas, I didn't mind. But for me, there were certain things I could pick and choose. But I would die for apple crumble. I still do, and I should really. I've got too much weight to carry.
When you came back to the UK, were you living with your family or living alone for the first time?
No. I came back with Mum, and Dad had stayed here the whole time.
Right.
So we were reunited as a family. And obviously I missed him because he wasn't with us, even though I had extended family, uncles and aunts. So it was really great being back to see Dad and, you know, be a family again. So I was really pleased. And then I finished my education at Highbury Grove School. Well, I finished primary school, and in 1968, I went to Highbury Grove School, which was a boys' school. And our headmaster was Dr. Rose Boyson, who happened to be Margaret Thatcher's Minister of Education, because while he was at school, he got headhunted by Maggie when she was in, I think she was Shadow Education Minister. And she came to our school, actually. And I remember she came, we were one of these super comprehensive, as it was then. And we were one of the few schools that had our own swimming pool. And I remember Margaret Thatcher walked into the swimming pool and I intentionally splashed her. And I got away with it. So my claim to fame is that I splashed Margaret Thatcher and got away with it.
It's a good legacy.
It's in the book.
And you, because you studied applied biology, didn't you, at university? When you were at university, were you cooking for yourself?
No, actually. I took the easy way out. Because University of East London is just down the road. So, I used to commute home. And then I had various ports of call where people would cook for me, which was really nice. My mother taught me how to cook, clean, iron. So I'm very self-sufficient, but if given the option of not doing it, I'll try and get away with it. That's what my wife's always telling me. I'm not your mother. Now get in the kitchen.
Tell us about what your mum taught you to cook. What's been your culinary inheritance?
I think good pot of rice, saffron rice, rice and peas. I haven't quite got the ingredients great for curries, but I like it, but no one else likes it. A good steak, but I don't eat that much meat anymore. Fish, so seasoning in the fish, gutting it. I'm not great on gutting it. And you would think, as an ex-scientist, I'd be good at sort of gutting things, but I'm not. So, yeah, I mainly sort of fish and steaks. She taught me how to do that really well. And, of course, a good pot of rice or potatoes, vegetables. I always was very fortunate. They always showed me the importance of fresh vegetables and eating well. And in fact, when I finished uni, I went to work at the Royal Free Hospital. And the head of the medical unit that I worked with was a woman called Dame Sheila Sherlock. She was a world-renowned specialist for liver and gastroenterology. And she always used to say, anytime she would have team talks, mainly with the top consultants, but we as researchers would pile in as well. And she used to start with, if food is not your medicine, then medicine will be your food. And I will never forget that. That was like the mantra. If food is not your medicine, medicine will be your food.
Do you feel you've applied that in your own life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Policing didn't really help. When I was a scientist, because we're always in that environment, we always used to eat well. And the Royal Free had really great canteen facilities or restaurants, etc. And it so happens I was still living at home for most of that time while I was at the Royal Free. And when I became a police officer in 83, I fortunately got married to Gretel and she took care of me. So, and she's still doing that now. But yes, it was really, really important to eat well and stay fit. So I used to do a lot of training. In fact, I was very fit when I joined the Met because I used to do like half marathons and swam and did a lot of squash. So yeah, I do a lot of running, sprinting as well. Yeah, so yeah, I realized you had to take care of yourself and, you know, have that sort of balance.
And what's the diet of a trainee police officer like? You slightly alluded to it there, that it might not be that healthy.
It's all fast food. A lot of officers, especially in the early years, used to live in section houses. So it's always takeaways. You can't really cook in those places. Fortunately, because I was married, we had our own flat. So I was eating very well, you know. Although I'm doing shift work, earlies, lates, nights. And sometimes you don't, it might resort to a quick bite but Gretel used to always make me sandwiches. So I've got a good, I'll go in with my packed lunch. It was more like a skip, really. It was a massive thing. You know, officers would say, who made that for you? I said, my wife. Oh, really? And they would go to the chippy or to the kebab shop or something.
Tell us about those packed lunches. What do you get in a Gretel packed lunch?
Well, a good sandwich, loads of vegetables or salads. Salads in, it might be tuna, cheese, Plowmans, you know, that sort of thing. And I'll always have a yogurt and fruit, loads of fruit. And if I'm really good, I'll get a Kit Kat or something. But no, you know, it was really substantial. So, but I had to be very careful not to eat, because when you're night duty and you're eating at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, even though you're busy, especially if you're at a really challenging environment like Hackney or central London or wherever, but you can, if you're eating too late, it can sort of sit there and not good for you. So it's a question of just eating light really and regularly, which I still do now.
And as a police officer, how important is it to sort of get to know obviously the local community, but in particular kind of the local cafes or places that are selling food? I mean, is that a kind of important part of policing?
Absolutely. I mean, community contact is essential. And there's this adage in policing. They say the definition of a bad cop is a wet one. So you cannot turn up soaking wet. So you have to have your little tea holes or places where you eat or you keep dry so that you don't walk in absolutely sodden wet on, you know, member of the public, because it doesn't look good. So you have to try and keep yourself dry and tidy. So, and then my first police station was Islington, and I was really pleased to know the local area because I grew up there. And Highbury was my patch where I went to school. So I knew the local area, knew the people, some of the areas where certain things are done, drug dealing. You know, as a youngster, you learn those are places you stay away from. So when it came to policing, I knew exactly where to go because it was from word of mouth. So I used to get some really good results around, you know, arrests and getting information about other crimes. So it was really good. So, and you get so much information when you went into a cafe and you sat down and talked to people, and or you go into a local shop and you just introduce yourself to the local news agent or whatever. And it's amazing how they say, oh, I don't know about that so-and-so person. Oh, yeah, I saw him down the road and he, oh, I don't know what he's doing, but it doesn't look right. So it's all right, I'll have a look into it, you know. And it's just information gathering. It was great. And talking to people, let them feel free to talk to you. And, you know, they know it'd be confidential. And there's no way I would breach that. So I found it very natural. It wasn't, once I got on the street, Hendon wasn't that great because of the culture and it was quite hostile at times. And police stations can be like that. In fact, they wrote a big N-word on my locker, which didn't go down really well, which I asked them to investigate, but they didn't really look into it properly. So I like being out in the street. I like being out in the street on my own, getting to know the people and letting my results speak for itself.
Is food something that's used as a kind of form of camaraderie amongst police officers? You know, the canteen and the fact that you're on shift work. I suppose what I'm interested in is you've written about the fact that you were often a lone wolf within the police. And I want to know whether or not that was something you felt you could be part of, or whether that would have been disingenuous. How was that experience for you of the socialising aspect?
Well, I had to make a decision before I joined how I was going to join. Now, I made it clear to myself and to the people who knew me best that I was a black man who happened to be a cop. So that for me, it meant I'd integrate with my values and my beliefs and my culture and don't feel I have to assimilate and adopt the norms and values of the culture. Now, that doesn't mean I'm standoffish, but it just means that I don't have to do everything they believe is the done thing. And for example, again, there's another comment that goes throughout the life of policing. If you couldn't take a joke, you shouldn't have joined. And they said it all the time. And in the, you know, and they would have jokes targeted at a person, laughing at them. I wouldn't buy into that. I wasn't going to laugh at jokes about people's gender, their hair color, their accent, or their skin color. I don't see why we should do that. We can have a laugh and joke and all sorts of things, but it should be at the someone being victimized in some way. So that took me out of the crowd who would be quite cavalier about these things. And I was never a heavy drinker, and a lot of policing, especially after work, is around socializing and drinking. In those days, some of the drinker was in the police station, especially with the CID. They would have their sort of poet's day Friday afternoons, catching up with a bottle of scotch in the senior officer's office. So the DCI or the DI would be there entertaining his DCs. And they would have, and sometimes you as a uniform officer, you go up there and say, listen, I've just taken this crime for whatever, robbery or burglary, and, oh yeah, put it over there, we'll get back to it. And you knew they weren't going to. You thought, okay, fine, I've just done my bit. I've got the reference number to give to the person. But yeah, I remember being on a murder squad. It was called a young man called the Stockwell Strangler. And he used to murder pensioners primarily by suffocation on the Victoria Line. And he started in Stockwell, and he turned up at Highbury, and that's how I got involved, because it was on our ground in Islington, and I was on the crime desk at the time. So I'd left the response team doing shift work, and I was doing investigations, and they asked me to get involved in that. And it was practically every day. Oh, right, to the pub, let's have a debrief. I couldn't do that. I mean, I'm not a big drinker. It's a lot better than it was. I mean, it was a given that you'd go for a drink after work, and then you'd stagger home that day, and then you'd grab a kebab or something on the way home. And I just couldn't do all that. And my wife wouldn't allow me to do it, so I just had to do what you're told.
And Leroy, one of the areas you've been fundamental in bringing about change in is diversity in the police force, and it's an issue that you've both spoken and written a lot about. Do you think that food can be a good way of bringing different communities together, perhaps if other ways have failed?
Absolutely. I think in you know, even in my faith as a Christian, I know the importance of fellowship and breaking bread and people coming together. And I remember even in policing where they have events, you know, Christmas events and Easter, you know, and especially when we have children and we take our children and, you know, our partners and we meet up and it's over food and everything. It was really good just to exchange different types of food and culture. And I think it broke down barriers, and it was learning for each of us to know more about different people's foods and culture. So I think it brings us together when you do that and really start to see how we can work together. And then we realise how much we have in common than what's different. And I must admit, I don't see as much of that now. It seems to focus on the difference as opposed to the commonalities. So food, I think, is really, really critical in building bonds. I mean, that's why we invite people around for dinner, pre-COVID, that is. And you go for a meal. I think having conversations over food is a good way of communicating.
And over the course of your career, I mean, you rose up to superintendent. We've talked about the positions that you've held. You've received an MBE. You've had a vertiginous career trajectory. Have your tastes or the way that you've eaten changed with your career as you became more senior? Or have you stayed sort of consistent throughout your life?
I think I've been pretty consistent, actually, because I was brought up with parents who were very clear on how to eat well. In Jamaica, we did the same. Coming back, my mother still continue cooking fresh food. Very rarely they allow me to go to Wimpy or McDonald's when it first started in the 70s and that stuff like that. So, yeah, I was pretty disciplined, and fortunately my wife sort of kept me in line as well. So that helps. So, and then I've got a daughter. She cooks really well. And I'm, you know, me and my sons, we do our best. But no, we know the importance of food. And I think it's also when I was working at the Royal Free, and Dame Sheila Sherlock and my boss, Professor Roy Pounder, it was just a continuous theme, and it's paid off, really. And I still, especially now with COVID, you have got to eat well, you have to take your vitamin D's and your C's. I mean, I'm not into popping pills, trust me, but maybe it's my science background. I knew you have to keep your immune system. I mean, I think it doesn't matter what you do, you know, with masks and social distancing and washing hands and all that sort of stuff, you can still get this virus. And I think from time to time you get exposed to it, you just have to know how to make sure your immune system can do its best to keep it at bay, because it can happen to anyone, I believe. And well, unless you live in a bubble, and not many of us can afford bubbles anyway. So no, I think food is really important. And I used to be involved in distributing some chia seeds. And there was chia seeds is one of the greatest sources of amino acids. And plant-based chia seeds. You get it in cod liver oil and stuff like that, but I hate that. So chia seeds is great. And I remember someone saying, you always have to keep your plumbing humming.
Words to live by.
Keep your plumbing humming.
Very sensible. Leo, we normally ask at this point sort of about comfort food. What's your comfort food? When you get home after a long day's work, what do you eat?
When I'm like reading or studying, I'm terrible for grazing on biscuits, and I like to mix it up with nuts, and you know, I'm when I get the munchies. Like, so anytime I used to do the exams in the police, and you're prepping for an assessment centre or an interview or whatever, I'm terrible for getting the munchies. And when I used to train a lot, it didn't matter. But now I'm not as active as I used to be. It's a perfect storm of getting overweight. But I've got even now, I'm doing a lot of studying, especially when I was writing the book and doing the research around that. I got myself a bike. I used to cycle a lot when I was in the Met, but my son borrowed it and I never saw it again. So I had to get another one. So I've got a quintessentially English Brompton foldable bike, and I take it everywhere. So at least that helps me to keep the calories down, even when it's inclement weather like this. So yeah, I try and even though I might have a bit of a bad day with the nut with the biscuits, the nuts is okay, but I like to keep it balanced with fruit and vegetables. So I will try my best to try and burn some of the calories. I do quite a lot of walks because I've got the forest as my front garden, so it'd be rude not to go out walking on a regular basis as well as cycling.
And tell us, what would your desert island meal be?
My desert island meal. It's desert island. Has it got any fresh water?
We can probably arrange some for you.
If given the choice, I would like to have a nice fresh salmon. You know that they come out the sea and they go up the river, and when that's when they get really mature. So if they can make it upstream, I'll be there sitting there waiting for them. So yeah, a nice salmon. Yeah, with what the local vegetation is, as long as it's not poisonous. I'll try it on this desert island. So if it's any sort of, I mean, I went on the Amazon after I left the Met. I had to deprogram myself. So I went 3 weeks in Ecuador and Peru, which sort of perimeters around the Amazon forest. And I must admit, the food was all, so the indigenous population would be our guides. They used to have these lemon flavored ants. Yeah, and you said, what is that? And so the ants, it tastes like lemons. It's crazy. Yeah, some of the food was just amazing. And so yeah, so I would like to have a bit of salmon and the local vegetables, and yeah, that'd do me fine. A bit of salad, I'm great.
Surely an apple crumble and custard for pudding.
Well, it would be. I'm sure I'd have it in my survival pack. A dehydrated version of apple crumble, only for real emergencies,
Of
a real
course, of
craving,
course.
only as a rarity. But I think I'll worry after my first 200 helpings. I might be a bit worried if I'm going to get rescued.
Leroy, thank you so much for joining Table Talk. And Leroy's new book, Closing Ranks, My Life as a Cop, is available now.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories, and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.